That mandolin go da 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 dum bum. But anyway, would have fit in that piece. I'm so glad that Gary is following you, because I think this will be sort of a provocative pairing. Gary Gallo is the audio engineer.
Gallo.
We've been calling you Gary Gallo for years. Yeah, thank you. Audio engineer in the Crane School of Music, the State University of New York at Potsdam, where Gary Gallo also teaches courses in music literature. He's the author of over 160 published articles and reviews on both musical and technical subjects, and is the sound recording review editor of the Arts Journal and co-chair of the Arts Technical Committee.
Thanks, Sam.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here. Does everyone have a handout? I put six in each row. There should be plenty to go around. I have a few extras here if anybody needs one. Yeah, there's more on the front row, too. Okay, so everyone has a handout. Very good. Among the most important contributions of recorded sound is the documentation of performances by composers of important works and performers who gave the world premieres. Sound recordings made during the very late 19th and early 20th centuries offer invaluable insights into performance practices of that era and must be considered an essential part of scholarly research on performing styles during that time. The performances chosen for this presentation will offer viewpoints on the works in question that are often at odds with current fashion and taste, some strikingly so. My presentation today will feature works by Holst, Brahms, Mussorgsky through his arranger Rimsky-Korsakov, Verdi, and Elgar. Gustav Holst recorded his suite for large orchestra, The Planets, twice, acoustically in 1923 and again electrically in 1926. Though Holst was not a professional conductor, his two recordings of the work offer a number of valuable insights for prospective performers. The composer gave no metronome markings in the score, and the first movement, Mars, in 5/4 time, is marked simply allegro. In both recordings, the composer adopted an unusually brisk tempo, one which gives a feeling of two beats to the measure in groups of 3+2, rather than the more customary 5. Here is the conclusion of Mars, the composer's electrical recording made by English Columbia in 1926.
Thank you.
was not unusual during this time for performers to adopt tempi in recording sessions faster than those they might take in actual performance to accommodate the 4 to 4.5 minute time limitation of the 12-inch 78 RPM record. This was clearly not the case in the recording we just heard, however. At the composer's tempo, Mars takes just over 6 minutes. Since the movement was spread over two 78 RPM sides, 12-inch, Holtz could have taken at least two and possibly up to 3 more minutes had he so desired. The unusually rapid tempo employed in this performance was clearly the composer's choice. Few conductors have even approached the composer's tempo in this work. In 1994, John Elliott Gardner recorded The Planets with the Philharmonia Orchestra. Gardner is a conductor known for his concern with performance practice issues, yet in his performance of Mars, he adopted one of the slowest tempos on record. Here is a brief portion of the Gardner recording. Probably the oldest surviving recording made by a composer-performer of major stature is the wax cylinder of Johannes Brahms performing a fragment of his Hungarian dance number 1 in G minor. The recording was made in 1889 by Theo Vangemann, a European representative of Thomas Edison, at the home of Dr. Richard Fellinger in Vienna. And the Fellingers were friends of the composer. In 1935, Fritz Bose copied the cylinder to a disc record by placing a microphone in the horn of a cylinder phonograph. It is from this crude copy that subsequent transfers on LP and CD were derived. Most transfers are incomplete, missing a portion of the spoken introduction, plus a very short fragment of another composition at the end. In 1997, the English label Symposium released the first transfer of the entire recording. There is still considerable debate surrounding the identity of the speaker or speakers at the beginning of the recording and exactly what was spoken. Some credit the introduction to Brahms himself, others claim it is Theo Vangemann, and still others credit Vangemann for the opening line and Brahms for the remainder. Further debate surrounds exactly what was said. One view is that Brahms can be heard offering a greeting to Thomas Edison, while others hear the location of the event as being identified as Haus von Herrn Dr. Fellinger. Those issues need not concern us further. In 1994, Jonathan Berger and Charles Nichols, both on the faculty of Yale University at that time, performed a detailed analysis based on a digital reconstruction of the recording. The results of their work were published in the Leonardo Music Journal. It was the author's hope that their work might contribute to a better understanding of performance practice in the 19th century. In particular, the composer's improvisations, deviations from his own written score, were deemed noteworthy. A contrast to the rather clinical analysis of Berger and Nichols was given by Will Crutchfield in the August 1987 issue of the now-defunct Opus magazine. In that article, Crutchfield makes a number of perceptive musical observations on the performance. Here is the Brahms cylinder, recorded in 1889. The portion of the score played by the composer is shown on the third page of your handout, and I've indicated the starting point with an arrow in the score. Thank you. As Fred Maroth used to put on his LPs, the crackles and distortions are on the original source. Your pressings are perfect. While it would be a trifle optimistic to claim that this recording unlocks a Rosetta Stone on 19th century performance practice, the freedom in Brahms' playing is noteworthy. Also distinctive are the composer's sharply punctuated rhythms, especially the syncopations, and the deliberate manner in which he sometimes places the left hand slightly before the right on accented downbeats. We must bear in mind, however, that this performance was given among friends in an informal setting. Whether or not it might be representative of what the composer had in mind for a public performance is impossible to determine. The 19th century violinist Joseph Joachim, a close friend of Brahms, made an arrangement of the Hungarian dance for violin and piano. The 72-year-old violinist, who was born in 1831, recorded his arrangement in 1903. And some of the freedom with tempo heard in the composer's own performance is also evident in Joachim's recording. Joachim's general approach, however, is rather different from the composer's, being more broadly phrased and less rhythmically emphatic. Perhaps even more important is Joachim's use of portamento and vibrato. His portamento, the connecting of one note to the next with a slide, is quite generous, whereas his use of vibrato, as noted by Beatrix Borchardt in the second edition of the New Grove Dictionary of Music and Musicians, is rather sparing. Joachim does not employ the continuous vibrato that was being adopted by Fritz Kreisler and others around that time, but he does use vibrato for expressive effect and to heighten the intensity near the ends of sustained notes. This recorded evidence runs contrary to the claims of some, including conductor Roger Norrington, that there was no vibrato in 19th century string playing. Here is Joachim's recording of Brahms' Hungarian Dance No. 1, made by the Gramophone and Typewriter Company in 1903. Thank you. Perhaps no work can claim more creators than Mussorgsky's Boris Godunov, an opera that exists in two versions by the composer, two more by Rimsky-Korsakov, and others by Dmitri Shostakovich, Karl Rothaus, and more recently, Igor Buketov. Throughout the first half of the 20th century, Boris Godunov was known primarily in Rimsky-Korsakov's second and final version. Rimsky's final arrangement was premiered at the Paris Opera in 1908 in a production by Sergei Diaghilev and featured the Russian basso Fyodor Shalyapin in the title role. Shalyapin was hardly new to the role, having performed Rimsky's first version frequently since 1898. By the time he created the title role in Rimsky's second version, Shalyapin was well on his way to making Boris his own. And it can be safely stated that Shalyapin deserved as much credit as Rimsky-Korsakov for rescuing Mussorgsky's opera from oblivion. Fortunately, portions of Shalyapin's Boris were captured on records numerous times during his lengthy career, the most important being the excerpts recorded at the Royal Opera House Covent Garden during a live performance on July 4, 1928. Shalyapin is the prototype for what David Hamilton in the 1979 edition of Opera on Record called the acting Boris. Nowhere is Shalyapin's highly personal characterization more striking than in the clock scene captured during that live performance. During Boris's hallucination, Shalyapin uses the score as a mere point of departure, treating the vocal line as a Schoenberg-like Sprechstimme. Laid on top of the tonally vague orchestral underpinning, which Shalyapin undoubtedly knew since he had made a thorough study of the orchestral score, the effect is remarkably expressionistic. Here is Shalyapin's clock scene, captured live at Covent Garden by his master's voice on July 4, 1928. The piano vocal score to the entire excerpt can be found on the last two pages of your handout.
Oh,
At least three performers involved in the 1887 premiere of Verdi's Otello made recordings of music from the opera. The Italian heroic tenor Francesco Tamagno, creator of the title role, recorded multiple takes of the protagonist's entrance music, the farewell to arms, and the final scene. Several of the records were published. The French baritone Victor Morel, the first Iago, made two recordings of the passage in the second act describing Cassio's dream. Arturo Toscanini was a cellist in the orchestra at the world premiere. In 1947, he conducted a broadcast performance of the entire opera with the NBC Symphony Orchestra. Tamagno's recordings of Otello's Esultate are noteworthy for their rhythmically expansive, recitative-like pacing and methodical delivery of the text. Here is the tenor's first published recording of Otello's entrance, recorded by G&T at his home near Sanremo in 1903. The piano vocal scores to the Otello excerpts are on the third page of your handout. Toscanini's broadcast performance took place over 60 years after the premiere, and his conception of the passage we just heard is quite different from Tamagno's. Under Toscanini's scrupulous direction, tenor Ramon Vinay offers a largely in-time pacing of the opening declamation. The passage beginning Era la Notte in Act II, where Iago describes Cassio's dream, is in 6/8 time. Traditionally, baritones have sung the first four measures by placing an accent on every other syllable. This hemiola effect makes the beginning of this passage sound as though it is in 3/4 time rather than 6/8, as shown in the handout score. This is how Victor Morel performed the passage on both of his recordings. Here is Morel's second version, recorded by the Phonotypia Company in November 1904. The feeling of 6/8 returns in the middle of the first measure of the second line. Toscanini was in a more literal frame of mind when he conducted the 1947 NBC broadcast. Under his direction, baritone Giuseppe Valdengo follows the 6/8 rhythm from the outset, accenting every third syllable. The articulation of the word nota with the first syllable as a detached 16th note, like the orchestral accompaniment, further clarifies the syllable as the downbeat of a 6/8 measure. Mm.
ci tradia l'intimo incanto. Le labbra lente, lente movevano l'abbandono del sogno ardente.
Sir Edward Elgar was the first composer-conductor to leave a sizable recorded legacy of his own works. His complete recorded output has been reissued on compact disc, 5 CDs of acoustical recordings issued by Pearl, and 9 discs of electrics issued by EMI Classics. Unlike his compatriot Gustav Holst, Elgar was an accomplished conductor and served as principal conductor of the London Symphony Orchestra during the 1911-1912 season. String portamento was a normal part of orchestral performance before World War II. By 1950, it had all but disappeared in both Europe and the United States. The effect is used liberally by the violins of the London Symphony Orchestra in the composer's recordings of the Enigma variations. Here is variation 9, titled Nimrod, recorded by his master's voice on April 28, 1926. I have included the string parts to the first 17 measures on the fourth page of the handout. The notes where the portamento effect is most obvious are indicated by the brackets above the first violin part. Though portamento has not been fashionable in orchestral performance for at least 5 decades, one might expect conductors concerned with authenticity to insist on the effect. John Elliott Gardner's recently released recording of the Enigma variations with the Vienna Philharmonic offers only the slightest hint of portamento. Here is the opening of Nimrod in the Gardner recording. Thank you. performances heard today are but a tantalizing sample of a very large body of recordings by composers and creators of important works. I intentionally avoided the piano recordings of Sergei Rachmaninoff, since that territory was ably covered by our friend Don Manildi at the 1999 ARSC conference in Madison, Wisconsin. Rachmaninoff the conductor is a subject worthy of investigation in a possible future installment, particularly his 1929 recording of the Isle of the Dead with the Philadelphia Orchestra. There were, of course, other notable omissions, including composer-performers such as Richard Strauss, Paul Hindemith, Igor Stravinsky, and Dmitri Shostakovich, and first performers such as Enrico Caruso, Kirsten Flagstad, Wilhelm Furtwängler, Leopold Stokowski, and Serge Koussevitzky. These and many others are possibilities for future study. Thank you very much. Do we have time for a question or two? Do we have a question or two? Yes. Yes.
Did you play it at the pitch symposium?
Yes, pitch.
I agree
with that pitch, and that's why I picked it. Two reasons. Opal Pearl pitched the Tamagno recordings at about A440. And Symposium pitched them at about A435, plus I think the Symposium transfers are a bit more vivid than the Pearl Opal ones. Yes, I am well aware of the pitch and intentionally used that recording for that reason. Have I tried them lower than that? No, in all of the research I've done, I'm not sure there's really evidence to support a pitch lower than A435, but I don't think they're at 440. I do agree with Symposium.
Do you have the actual record?
No. Yes, Dick. As far as the issue of Portamento is concerned, no, I don't really think that that's true. Yes, certainly sound recording has influenced performance to a large degree. I think even more so since magnetic tape came into use and it became possible to correct all the mistakes in one's recording and make people play better than they really could play. And then what I think has happened over the past 50 years or so is performers go on stage in an attempt to sound as good as their records, and I think music making has suffered a great deal as a result of that.
Thank you.
Sam. Go ahead, Steve.
There is a continual loss of Portamento over the entire stretch of acoustic recording period. It's very clear in the Sabino records of the Lohengrin Act 1 trailer, for example, in 1906, if I remember right, that was out on Victor as a single side for many years and doubled, that the Italians played a great deal with Portamento during that period. My theory about this, it may be a little bit unpopular here, but the Damrosch Brahms Second Symphony, third movement that he recorded acoustically, and then a few years later as a complete performance electrically. The acoustical one has a considerable amount of Portamento, the electrical one does not. The difference, Toscanini, who insisted on cleaning up a lot of these practices in the American orchestras, this might believe anyway, and Damrosch was, this is the period of time in which Damrosch Orchestra was either going to be absorbed by the New York Philharmonic or was not going to be absorbed by it, or some of the people were. The way things ultimately worked out is that Damrosch played two concerts after the orchestra merged and then went elsewhere. And I think
I'm raising my hand. If I even make a comment about the two Damrosch recordings of the Brahms Second, I disagree that there's a Toscanini influence there, because the second one is still with the New York Symphony before the orchestras merged. There's no Toscanini involved in that performance. Let me say a couple of other things about Toscanini and Portamento. There's plenty of evidence of Portamento on Toscanini recordings made in the 20s and 30s, and I'll give you a couple of examples. His live Enigma variations with the BBC Symphony from 1935, although the Portamento is not quite as juicy as Elgar's own recording, it is nonetheless quite substantial. The New York Philharmonic recordings throughout, for example, the 1936 session. In the Semiramide Overture, there's subtle use of Portamento. And the interesting thing is that only a year later, he goes to the NBC Symphony, where you have an orchestra that really, there was a lot of PR and hype about the makeup of the NBC Symphony being a handpicked ensemble and all of this. Let's remember that in the early years of the NBC Symphony, they had a lot of handpicked first chair players and a lot of NBC studio musicians in the back desks who were not grounded in European tradition. And it's interesting that Toscanini goes to NBC a year after leaving the New York Philharmonic, and there's no Portamento in the playing. I don't believe that's Toscanini's, or very little Portamento in the playing. Yes. Yes. Right. Dennis.
Studio orchestras where you can find it alive and well up to the late 40s.
Yeah, I quite agree with that.
Maybe one more remark.
One more, yes.
Just for information, I don't know if you're probably aware of it, there's a book called The Star of Performance on Record by Robert Philip, published by the Cambridge University Press, which looks at this in detail and goes through tempera in Berlin, 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 Mecklenburg. And for those who are interested, it's a very detailed study which picks up on a lot of the points of hearing. So it's
Thank you. Maybe you can get him to come to Philadelphia, and we can.
Thank you very much.
Don't forget Octave.